coming up next on 94.7 WPBC LP Charlottesville. It's Apropos of Something. Co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence, Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss the latest policies affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by Table 44 in Stanton and Moxie Hair Lounge on Preston Avenue in Charlottesville. And now, here's Ellen.
Welcome, everyone, to Apropos of Something. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville Resistance Radio, and I like to say Persistence Radio. Apropos of Something airs live every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and my good friend Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today, we welcome Sierra Gladfelter, working to mitigate the debilitating impacts of climate change on water resources in vulnerable communities across the developing world and here in the U.S. Her work has brought her to island communities in southwestern Nepal, riverbanks of Zambia, the high alpine deserts of Ladakh, India, and the Himalayan foothills of Uttarakhand, and she's also engaged in projects here along Virginia's coastline. In all of these places and more, she's been working to develop the most effective community-based solutions to cope with the disasters of climate change, flooding, and drought. We'll discuss her fascinating interventions and learn how some of the most impoverished places around the world have devised some of the most creative solutions to their water issues. We'll hear about this and much more from Sierra, but first, my friend Nancy Lawrence, are you there?
Ellen, I am here. The characteristics of Sierra, I think we should just put her in with the Avengers. I mean, she's definitely worthy of saving the world, saving the planet in so many ways, and being that movie just opened, I feel like we've got an Avenger.
We do.
In our midst.
I think my research has proved that to myself, at least, and I think our listeners will be very impressed. And I wanted to mention that Soledad O'Brien gets credit for this, and I'm going to just move right on to some of the news today. I wanted to join Soledad O'Brien in offering thoughts and prayers to Wayne LaPierre, the poor guy. He's being ousted from the NRA by insurgents and possibly by extortion within the ranks by Oliver North.
I saw that. I saw he has apparently some sort of massive clothing budget that I had not paid attention to. All the pocket squares, I guess, are costing like $200,000.
Yes, and not to mention the shell company that they're using to evade campaign finance laws.
Yeah, well, you know, if only that news will like stick for more than 20 minutes, you know, today or tomorrow. I don't know if you heard this, but the grandpa in charge considers himself a vibrant young man.
I did hear it.
That's what he declares. And so I just want you to know, Ellen, that Ian Fleming has created James Bond based on me. My bank account rivals Oprah. I've been 21 since 1981, and I move like Jagger. So there you go. You know,
yes.
So,
oh my God!
There you go,
so
vibrant
true.
Young man.
So true, so true. So I wanted to give a shout out to Apropos of Something has two new sponsors. We are very grateful for Table 44 Restaurant in Stanton and Moxie Hair Lounge here in Charlottesville. Can I just talk about Table 44's menu a little bit? They have an incredible brunch, famous for their loaded Bloody Marys and loaded breakfast fries, which are a pylon of sausage gravy, fried egg, cheddar cheese, and hollandaise. Another treat is the barbecued shrimp and grits. Yes.
Goodness. I have a segue. I can say that is where the UVA basketball team should wind up. Because I don't know if you saw this, but they've declined the invitation to the White House.
I did. I was ecstatic.
They're winning the NCAA. Yeah. I bet. I only just saw that today, but good for them.
And they should also go get their hair cut at Moxie Hair Lounge on Preston.
Thank you. There you go. Who else do we have? Yeah. And perhaps Sierra should visit them and see how they're separating their plastics and paper. I mean, let's get this all tied up together. Yeah.
That is true. That is true. So, speaking of Sierra Gladfelter, I'd like to introduce her as soon as I can turn my page.
I think we should just speak up for her for the next 50 some odd minutes, and then talk to her next week. See what see if she's. Have you turned the page?
No.
Is the page turned? No.
No.
All right. Then let's subpoena Mueller and make sure you do that so that that happens. Are you reading the
I'm ready. I'm ready. I'm ready.
Is that what's happening?
I was just saying.
Did you finally get it unredacted? Are you the one?
I was just saying, and trying to calm nerves around the studio here, that it's really great when people can just be themselves and make mistakes because people love it. So I'm hoping everyone's enjoying the page turning. So anyway, I did find my notes right in front of my nose. So we are thrilled actually to be able to speak with Sierra Gladfelter. She's the interim project manager for the University of Virginia's Institute for Engagement and Negotiation. And she's a development associate with the Virginia chapter of the Sierra Club. Sierra herself is working in areas devastated or threatened by the effects of climate change, such as flooding and drought. She works with interventions that both confront the roots of people's vulnerability with climate issues and that complement local knowledge and practices, which I find very interesting. She's the recipient of both a National Science Foundation Graduate Research Fellowship and a Fulbright Nehru Student Research Fellowship. She spent the last 4 years studying the impacts of climate change on water resources in vulnerable communities across the developing world. Welcome to the show, Sierra.
Thank you so much, Ellen and Nancy.
Yes.
Hey, Sierra.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask
you. Thank you. Here, let me do this while you're still turning the page. Thank you for being our guest for the whole hour. You are coming through when we needed you most. So we really appreciate that.
Yeah.
Thank you. It's an honor.
Great. So
we'll see about that.
What? I know. I'm already like just winging it here, but I'm really not. So what led you to pursue a career in climate change to begin with in vulnerable communities?
Yeah, that's a great question. In a lot of ways, water has led me to this work, beginning in Schuylkill County, Pennsylvania, where I grew up on the edge of anthracite coal country. And I had a family that made sure that I spent a lot of time in the mountains and along the rivers there. And I learned a lot about how our water system there had been impacted by anthracite coal mining for decades and centuries. And as I engaged in questions about conservation and development in this watershed, I decided that this would be the path I pursued in other places and had opportunities later in undergrad and graduate school to start to look at more complex, larger watersheds in South Asia, where billions of people depend on water that starts and originates from glaciers in the Himalayas. And so a lot of the work that I've done since has been in communities downstream from those mountains. But I've also been able to spend time in other places where people are facing the impacts of climate change in their own watersheds through more intense droughts and floods. And I've learned a lot from the people there about how they're adapting and coping with climate change.
I was just wondering, actually, as you say that, since you're way beyond the Appalachian Mountains when you study, how difficult is it for you just to do your work because you're not native to so many of these places?
Yeah, that's a question that I deal with all the time, and I think that any social scientist, I'm trained in anthropology and human geography, so in order to combat the legacy of cultural appropriation and exploitation that characterizes the history of these disciplines, we're trained to be very self-reflexive, and I make it a priority in my work to identify groups, community organizations that are deeply embedded in the places that I work, and shape my research to be positive and productive for the work that they're doing there. And so it takes a lot of relationship building with organizations and identifying people that can be collaborators in research, so that I don't become a researcher that parachutes in and captures knowledge and collects data and then, you know, benefits from it by publishing in it in distant places that are inaccessible to the people there. So for me, it's really important to, you know, work with people and offer my training and critical perspective to the challenges they're facing, but in a way that enables them to choose how to move their projects forward.
Yeah, I was really interested in what you do in terms of letting the community inform you as to maybe traditional practices and mm-hmm. creative solutions, plus your own knowledge. So could you maybe take us through perhaps some of the places you've been, like the Ladakh district in India yeah. or wherever, and tell us how that's working?
Yeah, so most recently, at least in terms of my international work, I spent 11 months in India on a Fulbright Nehru student research fellowship. And my host institution was in New Delhi and at Jawaharlal Nehru University. But my work was grounded in communities of Ladakh, which is in the Himalayan state of Jammu and Kashmir, in the rain shadow of the Himalayas. And so this is a place where people have lived with chronic water stress, at least periodically, for generations, for hundreds of years. And what I was interested in was how they understood scarcity and the ways in which climate change was exacerbating this problem for them. And for the months that I was in this place, I was looking at ways in which people have adapted to water stress and these new really creative strategies called artificial glaciers that have been getting a lot of attention more recently. There's some new shapes that they're taking, ice stupas. And so I was interested in the politics around these kind of modern creative strategies that are tied to Ladakhi traditions, and kind of unpacking what they were, what they are, how they've evolved over time, and to what extent they're enabling people to cope with climate change there.
Can you tell us what is it, ice stupa?
Yeah.
What that is?
Yeah. I think it's helpful if I explain what an artificial glacier more broadly is, because an ice stupa is this kind of modern version of it. So an artificial glacier works kind of using very basic technology, a series of stone walls that form terraced ice fields down a valley. And so people in Ladakh have built very similar structures for hundreds of years, maybe even longer, in the valleys above their villages. And so these stone walls across alpine valleys slow down water that's flowing from melted glaciers and melted snow above the village. It distributes it across the valley, and so it has increased surface area. It starts to freeze, and it forms these terraced ice sheets that can sometimes extend for over a kilometer or two down a valley. And so this has been one way that communities that have faced severe water scarcity have been able to capture treasured water resources, capture and store them for a period of time, and then slowly release them as the sun melts them in the spring for irrigation downstream. And so this tradition existed for hundreds of years. There is an engineer that has recently, innovated them and helped to capture this technology and divert money from international development organizations to it. And so that's where artificial glacier as a modern concept evolves from this tradition. And then more recently, some other Ladakhi engineers, Sonam Wangchuk is one of the most famous. He created the ice stupa, which works a little differently, but with a very similar concept, by taking water upstream, diverting it through a pipe, and uses gravity and a pretty basic pipe system to force water upward into the air. So it sprays out of these pipes that they can extend over time and forms a dome of ice in the shape of a stupa, which is in South Asian culture, a reliquary mound. So it has this cultural link to people's identity as Buddhists there, but it's a new innovation to a tradition of capturing ice in some sort of reservoir that continues today, and that people are thinking about how to do in new ways within the context of climate change.
And then that too melts in the spring.
Yeah.
And distributes.
Yeah. So it actually follows a similar timeline where the idea is in October, November, once harvest occurs and people have a little more free time, they used to go and maintain these walls in the alpine valleys above their villages. And now these ice stupas also begin to capture water as temperatures drop in late November. Ice accumulates into March, and then as the temperature warms and the sun becomes more intense, it starts to melt and help people irrigate their first crop of the season.
How dependent is this area, Ladakh, and surrounding communities, for all I know, but how dependent are they on agriculture for the water being obviously key to that?
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting question, and one that I think can complicate these interventions and the success of them. So traditionally, people were fully dependent on agriculture. I mean, there's always been trading. Ladakh on the Silk Road has always had people moving. It's always been connected to other parts of the region and world. But on a daily basis, people's survival was deeply attached to their ability to capture water, divert it to agriculture, harvest their crops within a very limited time frame because the season is so short for agriculture, and be able to secure enough for the next winter. That's changing in Ladakh, and it's a place that has increasingly become a tourist destination, not only for foreigners but for Indians as well, for people who are, you know, the rising middle class in India is empowered and has resources now to travel and fly places. So tourism has exploded here, and a lot of people are capitalizing on that. But even in the absence of, I mean, certainly not the absence, but even as people shift to more diverse sectors and the tourism industry, people there still need water. And actually what you find is that, you know, as Leh, which is you know, the main city in this district, grows and explodes in the number of guest houses and hostels here, people there need water to drink, to flush toilets. And so even as the sector shifts, people still need to think about water and their consumption of it. And actually, this puts more stress on the local environment.
We're speaking with Sierra Gladfelter. She's a geographer, researcher of climate adaptation. She's been all over the world doing her work. Stick with us. We will be right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We air every Saturday live. We are here with Sierra Gladfelter and, of course, my co-host, Nancy Lawrence, in New York. So, Sierra, we're going to talk a lot more about your projects, but I was curious about the impacts that climate change has on, or how social justice intersects with your work within climate change.
Yeah, that's a great question, and something I've thought about a lot, particularly as I've been able to have diverse experiences, not only in South Asia, but in the U.S. and Zambia, and sort of start to unpack these patterns that occur across places and the interventions that are mobilized to assist people in coping with climate change. And so some of the things that I think a lot about in my research are the ways in which people, you know, in Ladakh, in other places, are on the front lines of climate change, and yet these people are often those who are least responsible for creating climate change to begin with. I mean, if you think about Ladakh, since I've shared a little bit about my work there, you know, these people have lived a subsistence lifestyle for generations. You know, a lot of the villages that I was in are over 13,000 feet. People consume very little there, and yet these people are facing rapid glacial retreat, have, you know, in some years almost completely lost their annual snowfall. And so what I'm interested in is how that sort of desperate situation mobilizes projects and investment from other countries like the U.S. that has contributed a lot more to the problem, and the politics of who benefits from these projects in communities. Because a lot of times the projects are framed at the scale of community, sort of assuming that everybody within that community benefits equally. And the reality is that particularly when you have this global investment or aid coming into a country to assist it in adapting with climate change, there's certain people within each community that's able to capitalize on that or benefit more from it than other people. And so in all the projects that I've done, I've really been sensitive to who is able to benefit from a project, who is reached by it, who contributes to its vision, and who, you know, ultimately is able to benefit from it in the long term. And then sort of more broadly, you know, this opens up a lot of questions about this global discourse of empowerment. I've worked a lot with projects that use the language of resilience to mobilize action. And more recently, I've spent a lot of time thinking about that term because it has a lot of amazing potential to empower people and to really tap the creative energy and the history and the cultural resources of a place. And yet it also can work to shift the burden of change and of coping with the disaster that climate change is on people who aren't, you know, often the most responsible for causing it.
You know, I was wondering, Sarah, and I know Ellen and I have only talked about Ladakh, so that's, again, the example I'm going to use, but please, I'm sure there are others. But in what you just discussed about that, I was just wondering if even the attention that is being given to that place with these artificial glaciers isn't because of their agriculture, it's because of this tourism that you mentioned. Like, does it often happen that the places don't even get noticed until more important money is involved or more important aspects of solving it, like that, you know, like a country's tourism become the reason it gets focused on?
Yeah, well, so it's interesting because in my work in Ladakh, I spent a lot of time in the villages where people have had these traditions for generations. And what's interesting is the people in Ladakh, some amazing, you know, cultural reformers and political activists have been able to capitalize on exactly what you just said, the Ladakh becoming this poster child of what it means to be a frontline community of climate change. And because of that, they've been able to capture a lot of resources to fund projects like the Ice Stupa project and other modern contemporary artificial glaciers, which is great. But what I found in my work in Ladakh this past year is that in sort of capitalizing on that narrative and the ways in which Ladakh truly is a victim of climate change, there's also this risk of sort of presenting things like ice stupas as a solution to climate change. And so that discourse, you know, there's a fine line between celebrating what projects can do and then what they fundamentally achieve, because they're still essentially helping people cope with water scarcity and the chronic effects of climate change, and ultimately aren't a solution. So I think it's important to celebrate things and what they do achieve for people. And there's some amazing things happening with resilience internationally. But then at the same time, if it becomes a distraction from the need to work on mitigation and actually confronting the roots of anthropogenic climate change, it also, you know, could potentially enable us to continue to neglect that the root cause.
So how does it work when you want to go into a community? Are the governments asking you to come? Are they cooperative? And what are the politics involved?
Yeah, it's kind of, for the projects that I've worked on, it has depended on the situation. So I spent a few months in Zambia, along the Zambezi River in Kazungula district. And in that position, I was there on an internship with the Red Cross Red Crescent Climate Center and was hosted by the Zambia Red Cross Society. And so in that position, there was a specific institution that I had an affiliation with and an interest from them in working with them on evaluating their projects and thinking about the ways in which people participate in them and how they can be improved. In other situations, like my experience in Ladakh or my graduate research in southwestern Nepal in the lower Karnali River Basin, I ultimately identified those places as areas I wanted to spend time and visit, but then I invested a lot of time into identifying NGOs that I could work with and have productive relationships with and serve their projects in some capacity. So, you know, it's always a negotiation depending on the context, and, you know, and I've been mostly on research fellows for a lot of this work, which, you know, shapes my identity as a researcher and independent scholar. It gives you some detachment in a way that can be really helpful, not being affiliated with the NGO hosting the intervention. But I'm sure in my career and already I will be in different positions where I'm, you know, part of the organization leading the intervention.
When you go into some of these remote places, as a woman, do you have to shuffle how you handle your ideas based on traditions in that, you know, in that aspect as well?
Yeah, it's certainly a challenge. You know, because I am a woman, I think about gender a lot. I think that for other researchers who are men, they face similar challenges where sometimes they can't access the perspectives of women. I think, you know, we all have our positionality and privileges that limit, you know, how we engage or how we have to more proactively work on, you know, compensating for that. You know, a lot of the work that I've done in South Asia has been challenging as a woman. I've learned a lot about gender and my own identity, and I've done work in different capacities, sometimes independently, where in some ways I become a de facto man, in the ways that people relate to me. I have also done work with my husband collaboratively, and so there I've learned a lot about what it means to be a wife in those cultural contexts. But fundamentally, what the way that I sort of solve, address, or at least cope with the limits of my own positionality in these places is by thinking carefully about who I collaborate with and making sure that if I'm doing research where I need to access the perspectives of women, that I'm not working only with a research assistant and translator that's a male and won't be able to deeply engage in conversations with the women there. So it often depends on who you're working with.
Have you experienced differences in the way water scarcity or flooding affects women? I know mm-hmm. I've spoken to somebody, Gretchen Steedley, who works with Global Grassroots, who was talking about the vulnerability of women who mm-hmm. need to transport water yeah. miles and miles, very heavy, and then they're at risk for sexual violence,
yeah.
for example.
Yeah, I think these are, I mean, realities that translate across geographies and continents. Certainly, the time I spent in India on a Fulbright grant in Uttarakhand, I did less work there than Ladakh, but I was looking at spring revitalization, and women there, you know, carry the burden literally of moving water to their homes, particularly in rural villages. And a lot of the interventions there to revitalize springs are trying to increase the water that they have available to them so that they don't have to wait as long or travel as far. So there's very real gendered dynamics of who will suffer the most under climate change, particularly chronic water scarcity. You know, I've also spent time in Zambia, and I think this also gets at the limits of resilience. Sometimes we think about resilience and sometimes it sounds grand, like solving, or, I don't know. It has this empowering tone to it. But then on the ground, sometimes the things that count as resilience are so basic, like I remember when I was in Zambia, went out with some field staff up this sandy wash, a tributary to the Zambezi River, and we walked for like a mile. And I had heard about, you know, this intervention there that the American Red Cross actually funded the Zambia Red Cross to do with communities and help them cope with chronic water stress. And their people rely on rain-fed agriculture. And so I knew that they were, you know, helping women cope with water for their crops and drinking water as well. But we get to this bend in the river, and I see two women squatting in the sand, digging, deepening this this well that was in the bottom of the sandy wash. And I realized that, I mean, they had to literally carry bowls of water from this sandy pit in the floodplain up to their village for drinking water and for bathing. And then what we were bringing to them in the intervention was a metal drum to line that pit so that the walls were less likely to collapse. So that's an example of what resilience can look like on the ground. And I think it's important to recognize that in so many ways, it's really just addressing people's basic needs and the things that we take for granted, you know, here in America and so many parts of the world. And you know, while that's important to continue to do and to celebrate, at the same time, if we think that we invest in resilience and we don't address mitigation at the same time, you know, it's not a solution on its own, and it's important to be grounded about the reality of what it achieves for people.
Are you able? I don't mean to be so broad about this, so definitely correct me. Are you able to see or keep up with, like, local residents if they are equipped to handle, you know, the upkeep of some of these solutions or all of these solutions?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it varies so much
general,
by context.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, I think that's one of the challenges of development in general, whether it's around climate adaptation or some other aspect of poverty alleviation. You know, will people continue with a project after the funding ends and the International Development Organization goes home? And I think, at least in what I've seen, that so much of that depends on what the relationship with the community is like from the beginning. Like, do they have a role in deciding what should happen in their communities? Sometimes they're not even involved in any real, genuine way in identifying the problem, or it's just assumed what they're facing and what the solution should be. And I've seen that in so many places where, you know, there's funding for climate change and climate adaptation, and organizations come in, or the local organizations are already, their work is defined by what international development organizations want to fund. And so that's what happens on the ground. And if it doesn't match what people want or need, and they don't have the capacity to continue with it, sometimes it does disappear. And so in the work I do, and especially with consulting with organizations and helping them improve their projects, is really thinking about participation and what it means. And can you just have a community event where you solicit feedback from people? But who's going to show up to that? And sometimes it takes being more intentional and going out and capturing the realities and perspectives of people that might not have the privilege to be able to come to meetings you host that enable you to call something community-based.
Can you point out some of the interesting projects or the creative solutions that people in these communities have created? For instance, I read on your blog about the porcupine, the branch structures that were inspired by traditional knowledge.
Yeah, yeah. So I think, yeah, what you're talking about is some of the work that I did in southwestern Nepal in the Karnali River Basin. And this is a really amazing part of Nepal. It is this vast alluvial floodplain where the Karnali River, which drains the western third of the country, it kind of bottlenecks in the foothills of the Himalayas to this really narrow canyon, and then it kind of explodes onto the floodplains of Nepal, the Terais, they call them. And so there's this big fan of sediment and sand that people have come to occupy and cultivate crops on because of its rich fertility. Now, chronic floods have always been a problem there, but things like the privatization of property, development patterns over the centuries have pushed some people into more vulnerable places than others. And so what I was looking at there was how people were coping with chronic floods, some of which have been exacerbated by climate change, some of which development has actually made more intense in recent decades. And I spent a lot of time talking to the Taru farmers there who migrated there centuries ago, considers themselves indigenous, and they have some amazing adaptive technology for channeling water that flows across this system of capillaries, and water just moves. It's constantly being pushed by new sediment, and they had these really adaptive brushwood structures called banduas, and they're designed to bend and break with the flow of water. And so part of my project was understanding how those structures have been maintained, to what extent they're still useful, and how they're being replaced today by concrete structures that don't have the same flexibility and adaptive capacity. So there are these really creative traditions. I mean, in the Karnali River Basin, in Ladakh, some of these artificial glaciers that have the real capacity to be used today to help us deal with things like flooding or chronic water stress. But I think that it's also equally important not to romanticize them as solutions that will save people, because they've been doing them for generations, right? Like, it's not like it's going to be the solution to climate change for them. And to be honest, I've learned a lot by talking to the people there about, I mean, they have the most grounded perspective on what they can achieve or not. And people don't necessarily want to just rely on their tradition. Sometimes it's the NGO trying to sell it to them. And they're like, you know, we want piped water too. And we also want to have motorbikes, and we don't want to carry water from the spring. We want piped water into our kitchen. But there's still ways that these traditions and creative ways of coping can be used and merged with scientific solutions for our contemporary crisis.
And that's where you come in, I believe, with a lot of the work that you're doing. We're going to be right back. We're going to take a break with Sierra Gladfelter, working to mitigate the debilitating impacts of climate change on water resources in vulnerable communities across the developing world and the United States. Stay tuned. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're here with Sierra Gladfelter. But first, Nancy, let's do a news of note. What do you think?
Let's do a news of note. I think that's an excellent idea, Ellen. It's like we never talked about this before we got on the air, but I really like it. I happen to have a news of note.
Fantastic.
Yes, it is. Mine's about public health, a different kind. Happened this week in an attempt to politicize what had been a successful non-political public health program for like 50 years. The White House wanted to deny Title X funding to places like Planned Parenthood from informing women of abortion as an option. But 20 states and D.C. and affiliates of the American Medical Association and Planned Parenthood challenged that rule that they wanted to make, that change, and a judge this week granted them an injunction which applies nationally. This guy, Judge Michael McShane, said the White House was a controversial rule. It was a ham-fisted approach to public health policy. It was an arrogant assumption that the government is better suited to direct health care instead of allowing doctors from behaving like medical professionals. So he also granted, in the similar ruling, an injunction to stop that so-called separation rule where the government wanted to prohibit funding federal family planning clinics from that were offering abortion as a place where people could seek medical attention. Like 40% of Title X clinics in the country are where people just go for early cancer screenings and health care services for low-income families. So now the White House can't put their hand into all of that. His ruling helped prevent a public health crisis.
Wow.
That is my. It was to take effect on May 3rd, and now it will not.
Yeah.
So bummer, what do you got?
Bummer. This is odd, but I swear it's new news. Okay, maybe because the research was done, but research is the Rodale Institute say that if all farms and ranches globally used regenerative organic agriculture techniques, 100% of the world's carbon emissions could be recaptured into the soil within the first year. So in other words, it could save the world, is what this article has said. And it turns out that traditional and responsible farming practices that people have used for centuries before the rise of chemical agriculture are some of the best methods we can use to protect ourselves and the planet.
Wow.
Yeah.
Pretty important.
It's important. I feel like we've known this. I don't know if Sierra has anything to say about that. Not that you need to. But I was glad to see that it's made it maybe into the research journals, so that we can actually, you know, it's evidence-based now, perhaps, is the point.
Yeah, put it in the Green New Deal plan.
That's right. So back to our guest, Sierra. So how's it going so far for you over there?
Great, yeah. No, I think your comment about traditional agriculture is so interesting and relevant, you know, everywhere in the world. I mean, one of the things that I've thought a lot about is local knowledge and its role in these interventions, because, you know, there's a lot of power in these traditions that have evolved over centuries or thousands of years in places. And in some ways, contemporary interventions that tap that provide a way to, you know, merge them with science and allow that knowledge to contribute to how we respond to climate change. And so, you know, in Ladakh, for example, with the artificial glaciers, the attention that region's getting now is enabling some of these traditions to get recognized. And it doesn't always happen. I think it's important that when knowledge is recognized or solutions are recognized, that the people who've contributed that knowledge and developed it over a period of time, centuries, gets attention. So with the artificial glaciers, I realized while I was there that even though Ladakhis now are really able to capture and use this technology to get funding from other donors internationally, that the people who've developed them over centuries aren't often acknowledged as the kind of root and developers of them. And so, you know, I think that's a risk everywhere in the world, is traditional knowledge often isn't valued until it's proven by science to be effective. And sometimes that's what it takes. But, you know, there's always the risk of appropriation that's part of history. We see that everywhere.
So I wanted to ask you too about what people can do. I recently had a discussion with someone who's more involved in mindfulness and contemplation, because that's part of my personal work, where I work at the university. And he was saying, you know, the Dalai Lama is super, you know, worried about this topic, climate change, as many other people are. And he has approached and spoken with CEOs of companies and talked about what they can gain out of it. And so, you know, things like making the environment for them at the workplace an amazing place to work, and doing that in different ways to create incentives, you know, in different ways. So what is it that you, from your perspective, that people can do? I know you've been involved with a lobby in particular, but what is it that you think will actually change minds, and what can people do, people that are already on board?
Yeah. I mean, I think my work overall in looking at the impacts of climate change internationally and the realities that people face on the front line, the projects that exist to help people cope, sometimes can be depressing, sometimes can be really inspiring, but fundamentally it's led me to want to come back to the U.S. and at least spend time here investing in solutions and mitigations in a country that I am a citizen of, a member of, in the communities here. I can affect more change in a lot of ways than I can in other countries. Like I said, I've always tried to do research that's collaborative and that is shaped to produce both criticism that can improve projects and make them more inclusive. But fundamentally, even if I have long-term relationships and investment and continue to go back to the same communities, I can't do as much there as I can do in my own backyard. And so particularly seeing the limits of what resilience sometimes means in other places has made me want to work harder for mitigation and change here in the U.S. And so I think it's important for people to, you know themselves and think about how they want to engage. I think we all have something to contribute. Whether you are moved to direct action and want to engage some of the groups that are fighting fracked gas pipelines that are threatening to cut across the Appalachian Mountains and Virginia, Western Virginia, or you are moved to engage in our political process and be a citizen lobbyist and meet with your representatives and write letters to the editor. I think all of these ways we can engage, and I think it's important to recognize that even though there's these immense changes that threaten communities all over the world, we can have the most impact in places where we're embedded and understand the politics and can be sensitive to the social justice issues here in our own backyard.
Yeah, like Sarah, I know that you in 2015 you were on the coast of in Charleston in Columbia, South Carolina, and I was wondering what, since that is much more in our own backyard, mm-hmm. what did you discover there, and what did you discover there?
Yeah, so that was a project that I was a collaborator on with some other researchers at the Institute for Social and Environmental Transition, which is an NGO based out in Boulder, Colorado. And we were doing this post-event review of major floods that occurred in October of 2015 and meeting with different stakeholders in Columbia and Charleston to understand sort of what factors contributed to this becoming such a disaster in both localities, and kind of unpack the fallout, the response, the recovery in a critical way that could be used to increase those communities' resilience to disasters in the future. And so what I find is that, at least in the U.S. context, disasters are often a productive entry point into this conversation. Whether the language of climate change is used or not is not always the case. And there's, you know, that sometimes has its own problems in terms of not necessarily confronting causality. But, you know, people in the U.S., whether it's in Charleston and Columbia, South Carolina, after the floods there, after Sandy or hurricanes that are slamming into the East Coast, sometimes it creates this opportunity to reflect on the social aspects of disaster, the ways our communities are designed and distributed that actually produce the disaster on the ground. And I think that conversation can be really productive in the U.S. for having broader conversations about climate impacts and bringing more people into the conversation around climate change and climate solutions here in the U.S.
The work you're doing in the Sierra Club, is that, should we give you a chance to explain what you're doing there? I feel like we should.
Yeah, I can share a little bit about some of the groups that I've been involved with. At the Institute for Engagement and Negotiation, I'm currently assisting with coordinating a resilience project out on the coast of Virginia with seven communities on the Eastern Shore that are going through this year-long process of identifying ways that they can empower themselves and become more resilient to sea level rise there. And the Sierra Club has, been doing a lot of work on the front of energy and our transition to a clean energy economy, fighting pipelines, working on solar and wind and other technologies, but also looking critically at the social justice aspects of it and making sure that it is, that we are inclusive and that, all of us benefit from that and are able to, benefit from a transition away from fossil fuels to a cleaner economy. And so I think there's a lot of groups doing important work. I've also been involved with Citizens Climate Lobby and helped start as a co-leader a chapter here in Charlottesville, lobbying for putting a price on carbon and distributing the income raised through dividend checks to communities. And so I think people, depending on who you are, what your identity is, if you feel moved to direct action or political advocacy, there's a lot of different environmental groups that need help and can assist us in solving the problems, or at least moving towards solving the problems in our own backyards.
Thank you so much for being here, Sierra Gladfelter. There's much more information about her work, sierragladfelter.com, I believe. And please go there. It's a great site for anything that we may not have mentioned. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's been wonderful to share this hour with you.
Yes, thank you. Us too. It is our, I don't know what you call it, inaugural hour of a broadcast. Correct, Nancy?
Yeah, correct. Ellen,
I mean,
we span the globe with Sierra. I know.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks.
Stick around and we'll take your photo. You know what it's time for, Nancy?
I'm going to say no. I have no clue.
Not that. I just played the wrong music. How about this? It's time for the palate cleanser.
Hey, is it time for the palate cleanser? This time I actually have something that relates to more what Sierra does for a living than I did for my news of note.
Go for it.
But I don't have to go first. Should I go? Okay.
Please do.
There's a woman in the UK, a 23-year-old student named Amina Begum. She has devised a way of transforming eyeshadows into mesmerizing paints, which could prevent millions of tons of beauty products from going into a landfill. She's developed this method that enables her to transform old, unwanted eyeshadow palettes into these distinctive watercolor paints, bridging the gap between waste and art. And instead of stores tossing out damaged and dropped or discontinued colors and dumping them in a landfill, so she's rescuing them and turning them into these travel-friendly sets of watercolors. She crushes them into pigments with a bit of a shimmer. Anyway, it's pretty awesome. And if you're interested, it's called COS Watercolors. She's from the UK, so watercolors is with a U. COS is like cosmic. So it's coswatercolors.co.uk. That's what I got.
Thanks. And I'm going to ask Sierra what she'd rather hear about, black holes or UFOs?
Black holes.
Okay, black holes. Black holes for 500.
For the win.
For the win. Okay. So earlier this month, April 10th, scientists have obtained the first image of a black hole using some special, Event Horizon Telescope. You know what I mean. The Event Horizon Telescope in the center of the galaxy M87. And there were like 6 papers that published a special issue on this, and I just wanted to set you up, Nancy. That's really the only thing about it. To set you up about black holes.
Set me up about black holes.
I feel like you might be able to say something.
Pass ready? Is that where I'm headed after this?
I just imagined in my head something about the Trump administration and black holes. Because like if you stand in one, apparently
that would be nice. That's a great setup. I like that right there.
No, this is nothing to do with what I just said, but apparently if you stand in one, your feet are more pulled than your head, and then you would be exploded apart. That's
exploded
what would happen.
Apart?
Yeah, if you stood in a black hole.
Let's not put the articles of impeachment in there. Let's make sure we put them somewhere else, because I don't want those exploded apart. I want this.
All right.
Easy, within reach. Okay, anyway. All right. Sorry.
Anyway. Maybe I have time for UFOs as well.
Oh, go. What about them?
Well, we only have a minute left. But just like there was a recent uptick in sightings of UFOs, and the Navy actually drafted formal procedures to pilots to document those encounters, because so many pilots have reported sightings. And there's really cool video that was just released recently of what the pilots' reactions were when they saw these little things that apparently look like Tic Tacs. They're like, look at that, bro. Yeah, Tic Tacs. They're strange. They hover briefly before sprinting away at speeds that elicit gasps and shouts from the pilot. It's pretty cool.
So the Milky Way has like a minty fresh.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Is that true?
Yes. Once again, Nancy, you saved the day.
Breaking the ground.
With your brilliance.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm out then. Okay. Back to my black hole. I'm going in.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks for being here. Thanks, Sierra. Remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. We thank our sponsors, Table 44 and Moxie Hair Lounge. And our music, this music you're listening to now, is by Springtide. Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next week.
Yep.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to Apropos of Something this morning on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Join hosts Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence each Saturday at 10 for Apropos of Something. Brought to you by Table 44 in Stanton and Moxie Hair Lounge on Preston Avenue in Charlottesville. Show archives can be found at 947wpvc.org, or you can subscribe on iTunes.